Hey friends, I want to tell you about a new book out from Nav Press. It's called Fish Sandwiches. That's right, Fish Sandwiches. So it's a book about how to receive God's promises. Do you have something that you lack in your life? Or maybe you're like me and you have everything you've ever wanted and you never felt a sense of longing. I'm just kidding. I feel that sense of lack regularly, and if you're a human being living in the world, then I would bet that you do too. So the Bible, you know, it tells a story about Jesus feeding of the 5,000. It's important to our lives because we have so much to learn about receiving God's promises. And as Jesus proved then, God is attentive to our physical and our spiritual needs. So check out Fish Sandwiches. It's a book Max Lucado said is a joy to the heart and strength for the soul. You can find a link to Fish Sandwiches in the show notes of the show or online wherever books are sold. So go check out Fish Sandwiches today. You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go!
My guest, Emily P. Freeman, is the Wall Street Journal bestselling author of Simply Tuesday and A Million Little Ways. As host of the Next Right Thing podcast, she helps create space for the soul to breathe, offering fresh perspective on the sacredness of our inner life with God. Emily and her husband live in North Carolina with their three children. Connect with her online at emilypfreeman.com and on Instagram at emilypfreeman. Emily, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Thanks for having me.
So the new book is called The Next Right Thing, A Simple, Soulful Practice for Making Life Decisions. You know, as I was reading it, I was kind of struck at, one, just the depth of it. And in fact, I felt like it could just be a book about finding peace through Christ. And when you read the title, somebody could think this is kind of like a self-help type book of how to make decisions, which is a perfectly fine thing to write a book about. Did you always see this as a book about how to make decisions?
It's funny, when you think about writing and writing a book and positioning it in a marketplace, I think it's important to meet people where they are and give them what they want. But also, by the time it's all over, you want people to have what they also need. And so I think what I want, what people want, I think we want help making decisions. We really, that's something that we all nobody ever graduates out of needing to make decisions in life. So wouldn't it be great if we had a little bit of extra help there and some perspective? But on the other side of it, in my mind, always, I'm always thinking beneath the surface and subversively and thinking about where's the kingdom of God in the midst of this. And so while our, maybe someone would approach the book if they're struggling with a decision, and I hope they get help with that. But at the end of it, I hope that the decision is actually secondary. And the true takeaway is, what does it look like to walk with my friend Jesus into the next ordinary moment, no matter which thing I might choose? And so that's kind of what I hope is somewhat of the takeaway.
Well, one of the themes that I noticed over and over again in the book was that it's not so much the actual making of the decision or making the right decision, but who God is making us out to be, the kind of people that we're becoming. It seems like that's was a big deal for you.
There's something about the decision-making process, as I've taken notes on it and talked about it now for a couple years on the podcast, and then had interaction with listeners and friends and people, whomever, who are making decisions. It is an interesting thing that happens within us when we carry around an unmade decision. And there, it doesn't always happen, but if we're willing to let it, there is a formational aspect to decision-making. If we didn't have decisions in life, really there would never be any opportunity for change. I think that's when transformation happens, when we're standing sort of at a crossroads. And it can be really hard, but it also helps us pay attention, which is important.
You, I think it was like the second or third chapter where you talk about this idea of soul minimalism.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we all know about minimalism and how we think about it. You know, we think of like a slick house with no cushions, you know. But, you know, we know that concept of decluttering our homes, our house is Joshua Becker has a blog and several books about minimalism. He has a blog called Becoming Minimalist. And I have read him for years and appreciate what he says about how our stuff kind of can get in the way of our life. And so he talks about the literal decluttering of your house in order to live simply so that you can simply live. And so when I've thought about that, how our houses always have input constantly, but there's no automatic output. The same goes for our inner life. We have always have input every day, every interaction that we have with people, every email, there's always input coming in. And without a regular practice of soul decluttering, we often carry around all those interactions with us and the emotions that they evoke or the frustration or whatever the thing is. We carry those around with us and they can become super heavy. And then when it's time to make a decision or when we're faced with something that requires a decision-making process, that clutter that's there, it weighs something and it can get in the way. And so for me, decluttering my house is the same as on the inside for my soul. What that looks like is practicing silence and solitude. That's sort of what the decluttering process looks like. It's actually less active than the house decluttering, but it's something that happens invisibly. And I try to do that regularly, even for a few minutes a day, because there's something powerful about getting silent in the presence of God and recognizing and naming some of those things that might be cluttering up and giving myself permission to let them go because I no longer need them.
I mean, I know for myself, I have a real addictive personality. And so that will a lot of times manifest itself in like checking Twitter at a stoplight on my phone.
Totally.
Or Instagram or Facebook or all three and then repeating the process again almost immediately.
Like, why am I dizzy? I'm just sitting here.
Exactly. And there's an actual like physiological cognitive thing going on where my brain is being rewired, but has a real effect on hearing any still small voice, that everything else is kind of crowded out. And I don't know, it feels like static in my brain where I have a hard time focusing or being still or being quiet.
It's the truth. You know, Parker Palmer talks about how our soul is like a wild animal and it won't come out. You know, how animals, they're instinctively, they hide unless they're, you know, unless it's safe to come out. It's like if the woods are still, then they'll come out. But we don't often let the woods get still. We kind of keep things loud and that's, you know, we clomp around. We're never going to see an animal if we do that. And I think he's onto something there with that comparison of our soul. If our soul doesn't feel safe, then we're not going to emerge. And there's something about the silence that gets down to, you know, beneath what's actually happening. I think that's why people, I watched this documentary about these men who were summiting, I don't think it was Mount Everest. It was one of the big ones, one of the big tall mountains.
One of the big ones.
And he was talking about how the first several days, you know, it's like his life starts to fall away. But when you get out there for a few days, you know, you have to wait so at these different base camps so that you can get acclimated to the altitude because you can't just go straight up. You
know, right.
Your body can't take it. So there's a lot of sitting around. I mean, you think of like climbing a mountain. It's so hard and it is, but there's also a lot of waiting and waiting for your body to settle into this new altitude. And he talked about how once the everyday decisions of life fall away, which they do when you're doing that, it's this big, long trek, you're left with the stuff that really matters. And he kind of went through why it was, I think, in a way, he loved doing this, not only for the thrill of getting to the top of the mountain, but because what it did for him reflectively. And it allowed, I don't think we often get to that space where we allow ourselves to let the daily decisions kind of slough off the top so that we can listen for what's happening on the inside and hear the current, you know, the river of life that's running beneath the surface all the time. I don't know that we always feel safe to go to that space.
It seems like, too, there's something so counterintuitive about it because, you know, going back to decisions, when we need to make a decision, we feel like I need to get down to the business of making this decision. So gathering information or making a pro-con list or what have you, it seems that sitting and being still and not bombarding my brain with information is, it's really counterintuitive.
It's super counterintuitive. And not that there's not a place to gather all the information, but if we start with that, sometimes it just makes more clutter. It's meaningless. It's like when you are doing a home renovation, or you're planning a vacation, or if you have really tiny kids at home, it's like the constant needing to make decisions, something that you might really care about if it showed up to you in a vacuum by itself. If 20 of those things show up on the same day and you have to make a decision of all of it, it all weighs the same, and that's heavy. And you're just like, someone else might choose this. If I get asked one more decision, you know. And so I think that when it's those big ones, it can serve sort of like an anchor down into the depths. And it can be a real gift to give us permission or a reason to go there. But if we just start gathering, then we're just throwing information on top of the clutter that's already there. And wouldn't it be great to clear the clutter first, listen, get into God's presence, and then, or I should say, recognize God's presence with us already.
Be attentive to it.
Yeah, yeah. The whole like, and then God showed up. Like, well, he's always there. You showed up.
You just noticed.
You finally showed up. And then begin to name some of the things that remain unnamed. I think that's an important part of this soulful practice of making decisions, is that sometimes the reason why personally I feel stuck is because I have failed to name a loss, a joy, a grief. And sometimes when we name those things with English words, what they actually are, then we can move forward and say, oh, I'm hesitant to move forward in this decision because I'm afraid. What are you afraid of? And naming those things in God's presence can be really powerful.
Well, I think so many times, because we're so busy, because we're so bombarded with information, or for whatever reason, we don't know ourselves and our bodies well enough to recognize that we're, like you said, maybe we're grieving about something, we're sad about something, we're angry about something, but we didn't even stop long enough to realize that that's what's actually going on.
Right. And that will, if we're not careful, we'll just knee-jerk react our way through life, because those unnamed emotions, they have power and they can control things. Even if it's not emotion, even if it's just a belief that we have, or a false narrative that we have about God or other people or ourselves, those things can just, it's like the screensaver on the computer. Like, it's going to pop up if you don't.
It finds a way.
It finds a way, right. And I think it's smart what you said about about our bodies. I think our bodies are so wise, and they are always trying to tell us things about ourselves that our brains sometimes are the last ones to catch up to it. But just that, you know, what is that crick in my neck trying to tell me? What is that tightness in my jaw wanting to say? What message is, you know, is this my lack of sleep giving, you know, just listening to what our body might be saying? I think we are, you know, when God made us, he made us whole people, not parceled out, you know, well, your soul lives over here, and then your body physically is over here, and then your mind, it's all one thing. And so it's all connected, talking to each other. And we would do well to begin to learn to listen.
It seems like a lot of what we're talking about, without using the word, is just simplicity. You know, Richard Foster talks about in the celebration discipline, the discipline of simplicity. It's very similar to soul minimalism. And when we get down to simplicity about what is important to us, or what should be the main thing, the main focus, a lot of times that makes, when we get that right and we get clarity on that, it really answers our questions for us, or it gives us clarity in that decision. When I realize that, you know, the main things, the most important things, Jesus is who he says he is. I'm loved. And what's Jim Smith's?
I'm one in whom Christ
dwells and delights. Then one thing it does is it turns down the immediacy of that decision, or the stakes of that decision. Yes. It turns it down. Because no matter what decision I make, those other things aren't in question. They won't change.
The kingdom is not in trouble.
That's right. Also, when I keep those things in perspective, it often will show me what easily is the right decision to make in that context.
Fast sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. So you point out that Jesus, often when he has interactions with people, and especially after he heals someone or does some kind of miracle, he usually gives that person just one simple thing to do after that. That's one thing that you bring out in the book. Can you think of one example of that? And then what did that mean to you when you saw that?
I think the first one that comes to mind is when Jesus was walking through the crowd and the story where he meets the bleeding woman who's been bleeding for 12 years and she touches his cloak and he stops, says, "Who touched my cloak?" And the disciples are like, "Come on, there are a million people here. How can you tell that someone did?" And then Jairus comes. I don't remember the order, but Jairus comes out and says that his daughter is dying. Jairus is this really important official. And but Jesus stops for this bleeding woman, and he has a conversation with her, and then he heals her and says that her faith has made her well. And it was just a very simple interaction. And if it were up to me, it seems like that he should have gone to the 12-year-old girl who was dying, not to the woman who had been bleeding for 12 years. I mean, give him 10 minutes. She'll be bleeding probably in 10 minutes. You know, she's been doing this for 12 years.
Yeah.
The whole triage just doesn't, I mean, it's such a great picture of Jesus's next right thing mindset. It's like, oh, this person in front of me is my next right thing, my next right person, my next right interaction. But when he does go to this family's home and he heals this young girl and he's got really just not very many people in there. Her parents are there. And when he touches her and she wakes up and she's alive now after having died, it seems to me like, you know, if it was America and this was being broadcast, you know, Jesus would say something really profound to her parents, and speak some type of hopeful vision, cast some type of hopeful vision over her life about now, because you have been healed. Now, here is your vision for life. This is what you're here for. Here's your purpose. And what he says instead is to her parents, go give her something to eat. I mean, essentially, he tells her mom and dad, why don't you go get her some lunch? After this most, I mean, literally life-giving action. And as a parent and as a human, that's deeply relieving to me to hear that. It takes some of the pressure off, for one, of having a 20-year life plan, because if ever there was one that was to be given, it seems like that would have been a great moment for one, because he had everyone's attention.
Yeah.
But just to give them the word of almost, it's almost like, go make her lunch, and it was almost like a reminder of, and trust me as you do it, no matter what your next step is. And that was one story that's really stayed with me when I've been writing this book.
I mean, it's such a reminder too about God is aware of our physical needs and attentive to them as well.
Yes.
You know,
it's so true, because we do tend to, especially in decision making, we tend to think there's like this spiritual secret that God is keeping from us, and if we would only be able to unlock the secret or figure out the trick, then we win, and if we get it wrong, then we lose. But you're right. I love that he was recognizing the embodiment of life with him, and how, I mean, he came to a particular people at a particular time, and he left behind a community to spread the good news of the kingdom of God. He could have left really specific instructions written down, and we would have them preserved over time. And that could have been the way we do, you know, but scripture came through people writing things, lots of different ones from different perspectives. And that seems like a real risky way to do it.
Yeah. It seems like, and I keep coming back to this, God seems insistent on using us to show himself to the world. And I mean, like you said, like, he could have done so many other ways. It would have been more simple.
Efficient, even.
Efficient, cleaner. But God is, for whatever reason, is stuck on using us to, whatever, show who he is to the world, love each other, all of that stuff.
It's such a beautiful picture of the Trinity and the love that the Father, Son, and Spirit have for one another in their divine dance. And how they're always inviting us into it. And they're just, he's not going to do it through a 1, 2, 3, you know, through a, okay, here's what I exactly want you to do. And if you just do that, ABC, it's more relational than that.
You know, fear is a real driving force behind a lot of people's motivations for a lot of things. We're sitting here in a time where, you know, there's talk of of a wall being built at our border, and that's fear has been fueling that conversation for a really long time. And there are a lot of people who they base their decisions on fear. And I think there are a lot of people, and probably a lot of Christians, who, if they're honest, they could recognize that pattern in their own life, but they don't really know how to change it or what to do about it.
I think that's so true. I had a friend tell me once when I was trying to make a big decision about whether or not to. It was a great privilege decision. It was a great choice. I was invited to travel with Compassion International.
Yeah, you tell the story in the book.
Yeah, I do. And to go to the Philippines to see, you know, sort of the what that ministry is doing for children living in poverty in Jesus' name, to see what they're doing in Jesus' name to help. And so I was invited to go and to write and to be a witness, to bear witness to this. And it sounded lovely. And I was honored to be asked. But when it came down to saying yes or no, yes, I will go, no, I will not go. It seemed like the godly thing to do was to go, right? I mean, it's Jesus-y, like, I've got to do this, right? But it just, I was so uncomfortable and I couldn't find my yes. And I went back and forth and I vacillated, huh? But I finally talked with our trip leader, Sean Groves, and he said to me, Emily, there may be a lot of great reasons for you not to go on this trip, but please don't let fear be one of them. And you know, when he said that, I had to admit that I couldn't think of any other great reasons not to go. It was just my fear. It was fear of the unknown. It was fear of what I was going to see. It was fear of flying, quite honestly. Fear of getting sick in a foreign country, which is like my least favorite thing to think about having to do. But I couldn't argue with that question of, and now that has become a first step question, because I think if I would have had that question on the front end, maybe I would have made that decision more quickly. But now in life, when I have decisions to make, I do ask myself that question. Am I being pushed around by fear, or is there a way in which I'm being led by love? And that often is the only question I need to ask myself. Not always, but often.
So I went with Compassion to Sri Lanka a couple of years ago. And I will say, those plane rides are no small thing. Luckily, I was, you know, feeling fine the entire time. But it's a big deal. To be locked in a steel tube for 12 hours, it's a big deal. In my book.
It's so big. Yeah. And like, you know, it's a skyscraper, essentially. On its side, they stick some planes in it.
Floating in the air, no big deal.
You float around. They don't let you stop or get off. You're stuck.
No.
I can't even think about it. Yeah. I've got to fly home after this.
I mean, yeah, I don't travel. I've only traveled internationally, well, overseas, twice. But I would have to do some work if that was like part of my regular life.
Yeah.
If there weren't years between those experiences.
Right. You have to find a way to manage.
To deal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. So you had this great chapter, I think it's towards the end, about gathering co-listeners. Mm-hmm. And that kind of idea, especially just within the church, about discerning together. I've just kind of discovered that for the first time in the last several years of my life, and just how powerful that is, and that just the testimony of the Holy Spirit working through the community together, and also how anathema that is to the American way, to come and discern something together with other people. So you and your husband did this, a form of this, with you and your friends. What did that look like?
You know, just like you, it's only been the last few years that I've begun to learn about this in a more, I don't want to say formal, but like this is a thing that people do.
There have been streams of Christianity that have
the Quakers
been practicing this for a long time.
There's so much we can learn from them. But when John and I gathered some co-listeners, I didn't know anything about that. This was just instinctual. Like, you know, we were in a crossroads with him vocationally, and he's a pastor. And so we were 12 years in youth ministry, and we felt like there was a transition coming, but and then we transitioned out. He transitioned out of that job amicably, but we knew something was coming. We didn't know what it was. And that question mark of Ann Patchett has a whole book she wrote called What Now? It's actually a graduation speech she gave at Sarah Lawrence
College. Commencement speech, yeah.
Yes. And the reason I even read that book is because I was at the library during that time of vocational questioning. And the title is What Now? ? And that's a question I was literally asking myself. What now? Which I've now answered it with just do the next right thing. been really helpful. But at that time, I did not know about, you know, the Quakers' tradition of using, of having a clearness committee. Or Ruth Haley Barton has a great book about sort of this community discernment process. But I didn't know any of that. So all I knew was that John and I had prayed, we had talked with one another, and we have come to a place where we really weren't sure. We knew something was next. We didn't know what it was. And we knew we had this gold mine of people in our life, but everybody's busy. And, you know, it's, you don't naturally, even if you're in a community group at church or like have a regular rhythm of meeting with people in your church, or just in your neighborhood, it's easy to just sort of get into the rhythms of you get together, you chit chat, you have a meal, you talk about a, you know, scripture maybe, and then everybody goes home. So we wanted to invite people into our home and ask for the specific reason. We told them before they came, we didn't trick them, but we just said, you know, John, we're in a, and they knew we were in a vocational transition, and we would love it if you would be willing to come. And you don't have to come with answers, but if you would just be willing to come as our friends and just listen to us say words in the room together. And maybe if you would just hold open some space for us to do that. And then you can ask, maybe if you'd be willing to ask some curious questions. You know, we didn't really know what to ask them to do or how to do this. It was very, we kind of tripped our way through it, but they came, and we didn't just ask our closest friends. We asked a few close friends, but so asked some mentors and some, you know, friends that have counseled us over the years, and older couples who we knew. It was maybe 10 people who came. They came once and then again maybe 4 months later or so. And it was so valuable. It was so life-giving. They did not, you know, give us this great advice that changed everything, but they did give us connection, which I think is what we really deeply long for. And also to have people in the room to say, you know what, you're not crazy.
Yeah.
It's really helpful just to have people in your corner. I think sometimes we often do have people in our corner, but it's not until something goes real bad wrong that we know it. And it was nice to have, know that people were there, even though we were just sort of questioning some things. It wasn't, we didn't have to wait until tragedy, to give our friends the opportunity to be a part of our lives, and they were happy to do it.
It's interesting how sometimes in my life, I feel like I've thought of every possibility and everything, and there's no way out. And then I bring someone else in and they're like, well, how about this?
What about this?
Like, what?
Changes everything. And sometimes as a person on the other side of that, I've heard someone who seems like they've gone through all the things.
Yeah.
And I'm the one who thinks it in my head. I'll think, well, I wonder. And I'm almost sometimes hesitant to say because it seems so obvious. But so many times, like 9 times out of 10, if I'm willing to say it and just ask the question, a lot of times that's a little, it's a little unlocking or a little something that, again, it's not necessarily an answer, but it's just one more next right thing
that's
can
right.
open up. And that's,
yeah,
it's really interesting when that happens.
I was listening to, there's this Luther scholar, a scholar on Martin Luther, and he said one of the things that led Luther to, you know, start what we know as the Reformation was that he believed that the true Church of God could not be wrong about anything. And so, therefore, since he felt the Catholic Church was wrong, it couldn't have been the true church. And I thought, that is very interesting. I mean, I think he was wrong in his logic, because I think now that we've got, you know, about 2,000 years of church history, we could see a few times where the church got it wrong. Just a couple times.
Right.
What I love about it is that he had such trust in the Holy Spirit speaking through the church. And if we had that kind of trust in our co-listeners, that we could come together and that we could discern together, that's a big deal.
It's a big deal. And the best way, I think sometimes we can get discouraged because we might look around and say, there's nobody I could ask to be a co-listener. But one great first step is to be a co-listener for someone else. That's such a gift. I mean, the gift of listening, the gift of faithful presence in the lives of other people is sometimes if I'm able to be that listening ear for someone, not in a, you know, martyr kind of a way, but just in a community coming alongside of way, it's life-giving both ways in my experience.
Yeah. And knowing, and like you said, being on both sides of it, but being with someone and knowing that I love you and I'm for your good. And a lot of times people will say things and speak things into us that we didn't even know is true about ourselves. I found this with my closest friends. Like maybe I'm trying to make this decision or whatever. And I think, well, there's that, but I can't do that. I don't have the whatever, the skill, the talent, the gifting to do that. And somebody else will come along and say, well, I think you're perfect for that, or you're especially suited for that. And then we could do the same for other people as well, that we see the reality. And we have so many, a lot of times we believe these stories about ourselves that aren't necessarily true. And it takes someone else saying, well, I've not experienced you that way. I actually think you're very good at this, or well suited for this, or what have you.
It's the opposite of giving your critics words. I think I had an Uber driver once share about her one negative review, a negative review she got. Because I was like, you've got great reviews. It was in Chicago. It's my friend Shannon. We were going around. And I saw she had these fantastic reviews on Uber. And I said, I was like, wow, you're doing good. She was like, you know, it's a pretty good job. And I do pretty good work. And I really like it. Except that one lady that one time. And I was like, oh boy, we are going to get a story now. But the story didn't come, because she said, the next thing she said was, but we're not going to give her words.
Oh, wow.
And Shannon turned around. My friend Shannon was like, she turned around. Our eyes were big. And I was like, we're not going to give her words. I'm thinking, you know, I'm writing it down in my head, because it was so profound. She was just driving us through Chicago, saying her thing. But the power that we give our critics is monumental. And the amount of good things our friends have to say to counterbalance the words of the critic is kind of embarrassing sometimes for me personally. Yeah. So the practice, the spiritual discipline of not giving our critic words is one that can be really healing and can help me do my next right thing that might be obvious to my friends. But because I'm believing that false narrative that some critic has said and has spoken into me, sometimes the critic is me, honestly,
yeah, sure,
on the inside. We sometimes just need those other people who can speak that truth for us.
I mean, I think for me, one of the least favorite qualities about other people is, one, not being self-aware and thinking too much of yourself. And so the self-destructive way that I've combated that is to be like hyper aware of every insecurity that I have, and also downplaying any kind of like giftedness or thing that I might feel like I'm good at.
Right.
Lest I look like, yeah, oh, it's great. I go, yeah, I'm just happy all the time.
Right,
and
the best. So effective.
Yeah, feel so capable. But I mean, really, that's a time where a group of co-listeners can combat that narrative. And because we do live in our own heads, it's hard to see some things objectively, especially about ourselves sometimes. Like you were just talking about, we give undue weight to our critics. I might be able to recite all the bad reviews of this podcast that we've been talking to you.
I bet you remember every adjective.
That's right.
Like, we just remember that stuff. It sticks with us.
Yeah, absolutely. So it helps to have someone speak some truth into our lives.
It does, over and over again.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, on a regular.
Multiple times.
Yeah. So I think, and this is something that you raise in the book, that just knowing ourselves is really important. Obviously, I mean, I do have friends who they'll make some kind of decision, and I think, just knowing who they are, I don't think that's going to go well for them, you know? But so many of us really don't know ourselves that well.
I think it's sometimes, I don't know, I can't speak for all people. I will speak for myself. In the past, when I have lacked that self-awareness, it's been, sometimes it's because we're afraid to admit what we most deeply long for. Mm. And that keeps us, though, from accessing a lot of stuff. When we can't access desire, we also often can't access our true self and who we really are. But the reality is, what we want is what we want, no matter if we admit it or not. And so it's going to come out sideways if we aren't willing to admit it. And so what better way to move forward and to unleash something than to be willing to admit what I want, which is different from demanding what I want. I think sometimes we clump those things together and say, oh, well, it's selfish to have desires and to want a thing. It could be selfish, especially if you demand it. But just confessing, doing it as a practice of confessing your desire in the presence of God, can be really beautiful. It can be healing. It can be a gift to your family because when I want something but I'm not willing to admit it, then I might walk around resentful in my family. I might be short. I might be frustrated. And I take it out on people who have no idea what's going on with me. But it's because I have an unmet desire and I haven't been willing to admit it. Let it be out in the open. Maybe grieve it. But then I can more quickly let it go. But first, I have to admit that it was there.
Mm. I think for a lot of us to do that, we'd have to let go of maybe a way that we've always seen ourselves. And I guess it goes back to the false narratives about ourselves. And I also think that the root of that are some false narratives about God. If we don't believe that God is for our good, then from the get-go, we're kind of walking into this with a limp.
When you think about making decisions, especially if you have a weird narrative about God, it's going to affect how we make decisions. If you see him as a carnival trickster who is just kind of waiting for you to get it wrong, or who's trying to, you know, hide the right answer under these three cups, and if you can just choose the right cup, then you're going to be rewarded. I just don't think that's the God that Jesus reveals. When we see, you know, Jesus says, if you see me, you've seen the Father. A lot of times we separate out, like, I'm good with Jesus, I'm not so great with God. But Jesus said, no, you've seen me, you've seen the Father.
That's right.
The Father. And so Jesus is not a carnival trickster, but I think we see God the Father that way sometimes.
Yeah.
And it changes our posture as we approach decisions. We wouldn't, but we wouldn't admit that in English words. We might say,
that's
oh,
right.
God's
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
He's really good. But it's like Dallas Willard is right when he says, we always live what we believe. We just don't always live what we profess. Maybe.
That's right.
It's very different.
I had a friend who was telling me about some problems in his marriage, and he said, "I think it's God punishing me for these like mistakes that I've made in the past." And I said, "I mean, I guess that would make sense, except I think that God is for your marriage, so I don't think that I don't think that's a tool in his toolbox is messing up your marriage for punishment."
It's so, Jan Johnson talks about the metaphors that we often use when we talk about how we relate with God. Things like, and then God kicked me, bopped me upside the head, or he pulled the rug out from under me, or the other shoe dropped. It's like, I don't see him doing that in Jesus. I don't see that.
Those narratives about God are really everything. I mean, I've kind of put it this way, like it does us no good to worship the wrong God. So if we're worshiping a God who is vengeful or spiteful or who's just not for our good, who somehow, you know, gets glory from our pain, then that's going to reverberate on all the decisions that we make past that.
Indeed. And that would be a good God to let go of.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you've turned your back on God. That maybe actually means you've turned toward God, finally.
Throughout the book, you sprinkle through all of your stories, but one specifically is kind of about your husband and your family and just your journey with his vocation after he went on sabbatical and then kind of resigned from a job that he had had for a long time and a vocation that he had had for a long time. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that process was like for you?
Well, that was the co-listeners were a big part of that for us, of helping us know some of our next right thing. But before we got to that point, you know, John, I wish he was here to share that story with you, but he has been someone who, even when we were dating, sometimes I would hang out with him and then I'd go home and I'd be like, I feel like I know him less than I did when we first went out. And part of that is he was someone who it was really difficult for him to dream. And I've talked with other women, mostly women, who say similar things about their spouse, about their husbands, that, you know, I, you know, for me personally, I can have like, what if we did this? What if we, and sort of, because it's riskless, right? I mean, it's just a conversation. There's no money involved. There's no actual risk.
Sure.
But to him, to take pretend risk was a really big deal. And it wasn't in his language. He couldn't go there. And so sometimes I was like, well, okay, I guess you just don't want to do anything, you know? But it was actually during a period it coincided with, his dad got sick. His dad was diagnosed with lung cancer. And, from diagnosis till he died, it was less than a year, about 11 months. And it was during that time, I think there's something, really sacred that happened in that time for John. I mean, of course it was grief and letting go. But also he accessed that grief, but in the process, somehow, and I don't know psychologically what this is, but in accessing the grief, he also was somehow able to access desire. And in that space that was difficult and hard, I saw him really wake up to himself, to me, to God. Before that time, we had a great marriage. We really did. We related well to each other. We were friends. Things seemed healthy. But after his dad died and the year following that, was a real time of discovery. He was in working at that time still. We were kind of still questioning, like, is this the right place for you? But the job he was in at that time gifted him about 3 months off, which was such a gift. And it came as a response to him going directly back to work after his dad died, almost as if nothing had happened, and then not really being able to deal and trying to do all the normal things, like, you know, that you do. But when you're grieving, they become much more difficult. And so he, during those 3 months off of sort of rethinking and grief and conversation and prayer. And I mean, literally, like, he turned his phone in to someone and he had one of those like flip phones. Like, I think I had the number and that was it. You know, no, he was a youth pastor, the parent, nobody, no contact with anyone. That was a real gift. Not everybody can get that when they're in the midst of grieving, but that allowed him to sort of wake up to some of his own giftedness, some of the narratives that he had been believing about himself, about God. And then also desire that maybe what he might want and what he might long for. What happened in some ways for us during that time in our marriage was we were, you know, a year, 2 years after that, we were really starting to look for some vocational answers, which what one thing led us to meet with those co-listeners. But we recognized that in the searching for answers that we were not getting, but what we were getting was something that looked more like arrows, that God was leading us not really down a path, which is what we thought, but actually to one another. And it was like an arrow leading from him to me and from me to him. And God was bringing us together in this time of questioning. I think those big vocational times are such an opportunity, especially in a marriage, for you either to grow closer together or to kind of turn your backs on each other and get frustrated. And it's a stressful time, for us, that time was a real time of growth. Growing closer together and of listening together, being co-listeners for one another first before we invited anybody else into that. And sometimes that was frustrating because we really did want to know, yeah, but what are we supposed to do? Like, what's that supposed to do? But that was such a transformational time for us relationally. And so, you know, for anybody who's listening in that, you know, time of transition, take heart that if you are, especially with a spouse, going through a time of questioning, it is an opportunity. The last thing you want to hear is that this is an opportunity to grow closer, but it truly is. And that's going to help to build a foundation for all the future decisions coming down the road.
It goes back to, you know, God using these times to make us into the people he wants us to be, because like you said, that the arrow isn't what we want. We want, you know, maybe a couple arrows ahead or a 5-year plan ahead. Mm-hmm. But when we only get one arrow at a time, what we're really learning, yeah, we're getting a step closer to, you know, whatever the next thing is, but we're really cultivating trust and dependence on God each step of the way.
So true. It's so true.
Well, Emily, I'm so thankful that you've taken the time to come, and thanks for being on Seminary Dropout.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay, Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. But